Chapter 5. Single institution, but assert the great and omnipotent principles of comprehensive education everywhere and under every circumstance. I beg leave to say that I concur, heart and hand, in those principles, and will do all in my power for their advancement. For I hold, in accordance with the imperfect knowledge which I possess, that it is impossible for any fabric of society to go on day after day, and year after year, from father to son, and from grandfather to grandson, punishing men for not engaging in the pursuit of virtue and for the practice of crime, without showing them what virtue is, and where it best can be found in justice, religion, and truth. The only reason that can possibly be adduced against it is one founded on fiction, namely, the case where an obdurate old genie, in the Arabian Nights, was bound upon taking the life of a merchant, because he had struck out the eye of his invisible son. I recollect, likewise, a tale in the same book of charming fancies, which I consider not inappropriate. It is a case where a powerful spirit has been imprisoned at the bottom of the sea, in a casket with a leaden cover, and the seal of Solomon upon it. There he had lain neglected for many centuries, and during that period had made many different vows. At first, that he would reward magnificently those who should release him, and at last, that he would destroy them. Now, there is a spirit of great power, the spirit of ignorance, which is shut up in a vessel of leaden composition, and sealed with the seal of many, many Solomons, and which is effectually in the same position. Release it in time, and it will bless, restore, and reanimate society, but let it lie under the rolling waves of years, and its blind revenge is sure to lead to certain destruction. That there are classes which, if rightly treated, constitute strength, and if wrongly, weakness, I hold it impossible to deny. By these classes I mean industrious, intelligent, and honorably independent men, in whom the higher classes of Birmingham are especially interested, and bound to afford them the means of instruction and improvement, and to ameliorate their mental and moral condition. Far be it from me, and I wish to be most particularly understood, to attempt to depreciate the excellent church instruction societies, or the worthy, sincere, and temperate zeal of those reverend gentlemen by whom they are usually conducted. On the contrary, I believe that they have done, and are doing, much good, and are deserving of high praise. But I hope that, without offense, in a community such as Birmingham, there are other objects not unworthy in the sight of heaven, and objects of recognized utility which are worthy of support. Principles which are practiced in word and deed in polytechnic institutions, principles for the diffusion of which honest men of all degrees and of every creed might associate together on an independent footing and on neutral ground and at a small expense for the better understanding and the greater consideration of each other and for the better cultivation of the happiness of all. For it surely cannot be allowed that those who labor day by day, surrounded by machinery, shall be permitted to degenerate into machines themselves. But, on the contrary, they should assert their common origin from their Creator, at the hands of those who are responsible and thinking men. There is, indeed, no difference in the main with respect to the dangers of ignorance, and the advantages of knowledge between those who hold different opinions, for it is to be observed, that those who are most distrustful of the advantages of education, are always the first to exclaim against the results of ignorance. This fact was pleasantly illustrated on the railway, as I came here. In the same carriage with me there sat an ancient gentleman. I feel no delicacy in alluding to him, for I know that he is not in the room, having got out far short of Birmingham, who expressed himself most mournfully as to the ruinous effects and rapid spread of railways, and was most pathetic upon the virtues of the slow-going old stage coaches. Now I, entertaining some little lingering kindness for the road, made shift to express my concurrence with the old gentleman's opinion, without any great compromise of principle. Well, we got on tolerably comfortably together, and when the engine, with a frightful screech, dived into some dark abyss, like some strange aquatic monster, the old gentleman said it would never do, and I agreed with him. When it parted from each successive station, with a shock and a shriek, as if it had had a double tooth drawn, the old gentleman shook his head, and I shook mine. When he burst forth against such newfangled notions, and said no good could come of them, I did not contest the point. But I found that, when the speed of the engine was abated, or there was a prolonged stay at any station, up the old gentleman was at arms, and his watch was instantly out of his pocket, denouncing the slowness of our progress. Now I could not help comparing this old gentleman to that ingenious class of persons who are in the constant habit of declaiming against the vices and crimes of society, and at the same time, are the first and foremost to assert that vice and crime have not their common origin in ignorance and discontent. The good work, however, in spite of all political and party differences, has been well begun. We are all interested in it. It is advancing, and cannot be stopped by any opposition, although it may be retarded in this place or in that, by the indifference of the middle classes, with whom its successful progress chiefly rests. Of this success I cannot entertain a doubt, for whenever the working classes have enjoyed an opportunity of effectually rebutting accusations which falsehood or thoughtlessness have brought against them, they always avail themselves of it, and show themselves in their true characters. And it was this which made the damage done to a single picture in the National Gallery of London, by some poor lunatic or cripple, a mere matter of newspaper notoriety and wonder for some few days. This, then, establishes a fact evident to the meanest comprehension, that any given number of thousands of individuals, in the humblest walks of life in this country, can pass through the national galleries or museums in seasons of holiday-making, without damaging, in the slightest degree, those choice and valuable collections. I do not myself believe that the working classes ever were the wanton or mischievous persons they were so often and so long represented to be, but I rather incline to the opinion that some men take it into their heads to lay it down as a matter of fact without being particular about the premises, and that the idle and the prejudiced, not wishing to have the trouble of forming opinions for themselves, take it for granted until the people have an opportunity of disproving the stigma and vindicating themselves before the world. Now this assertion is well illustrated by what occurred respecting an equestrian statue in the metropolis, with respect to which a legend existed, that the sculptor hanged himself, because he had neglected to put a girth to the horse. This story was currently believed for many years, until it was inspected for altogether a different purpose, and it was found to have had a girth all the time. But surely if, as is stated, the people are ill-disposed and mischievous, that is the best reason that can be offered for teaching them better, and if they are not, surely that is a reason for giving them every opportunity of vindicating their injured reputation. And no better opportunity could possibly be afforded than that of associating together voluntarily for such high purposes as it is proposed to carry out by the establishment of the Birmingham Polytechnic Institution. In any case, nay, in every case, if we would reward honesty, if we would hold out encouragement to good, if we would eradicate that which is evil, or correct that which is bad, education comprehensive, liberal education is the one thing needful, and the only effective end. If I might apply to my purpose, and turn into plain prose some words of Hamlet, not with reference to any government or party, for party being, for the most part, an irrational sort of thing, has no connection with the object we have in view, if I might apply those words to education as Hamlet applied them to the skull of Yorick, I would say, now hie thee to the council chamber, and tell them, though they lay it on in sounding thoughts, and learned words an inch thick, to this complexion they must come at last. In answer to a vote of thanks, 7, Mr. Dickens said, at the close of the meeting, ladies and gentlemen, We are now quite even for every effect which I may have made upon you. The compliment has been amply returned to me, but at the same time I am as little disposed to say to you, go and sin no more, as I am to promise for myself, that I will never do so again. So long as I can make you laugh and cry, I will, and you will readily believe me, when I tell you, you cannot do too much on your parts to show, that we are still cordial and loving friends. To you, ladies of the institution, I am deeply and especially indebted. I sometimes, pointing to the word Boz in front of the great gallery, think there is some small quantity of magic in that very short name, and that it must consist in its containing as many letters as the three graces, and they, every one of them, being of your fair sisterhood. A story is told of an Eastern potentate of modern times, who, for an Eastern potentate, was a tolerably good man, sometimes bostringing his dependents indiscriminately in his moments of anger, but burying them in great splendor in his moments of penitence, that whenever intelligence was brought him of a new plot or turbulent conspiracy, his first inquiry was, who is she? Meaning, that a woman was at the bottom. Now, in my small way, I differ from that potentate, for when there is any good to be attained, the services of any ministering angel required, my first inquiry is, where is she? And the answer invariably is, here. Proud and happy am I indeed to thank you for your generosity, 1,000 times, good night, 1,000 times the worst to want your light. Speech. Gardeners and Gardening. London, June 14, 1852. The 9th anniversary dinner of the Gardeners' Benevolent Institution was held on the above date at the London Tavern. The company numbered more than 150. The dessert was worthy of the occasion, and an admirable effect was produced by a profuse display of natural flowers upon the tables, and in the decoration of the room. The chair was taken by Mr. Charles Dickens, who, in proposing the toast of the evening, spoke as follows. For 3 times 3 years the Gardeners' Benevolent Institution has been stimulated and encouraged by meetings such as this, and by 3 times 3 cheers we will urge it onward in its prosperous career. The cheers were warmly given. Occupying the post I now do, I feel something like a counsel for the plaintiff with nobody on the other side. But even if I had been placed in that position 90 times 9, it would still be my duty to state a few facts from the very short brief with which I have been provided. This institution was founded in the year 1838. During the first 5 years of its existence, it was not particularly robust, and seemed to have been placed in rather a shaded position, receiving somewhat more than its needful allowance of cold water. In 1843 it was removed into a more favorable position, and grafted on the nobler stock, and it has now borne fruit, and become such a vigorous tree that at present 35 old people daily sit within the shelter of its branches, and all the pensioners upon the list have been veritable gardeners, or the wives of gardeners. It is managed by gardeners, and it has upon its books the excellent rule that any gardener who has subscribed to it for 15 years, and conformed to the rules, may, if he will, be placed upon the pensioners' list without election, without canvass, without solicitation, and as his independent right. I lay very great stress upon that honorable characteristic of the charity, because the main principle of any such institution should be to help those who help themselves. That the society's pensioners do not become such so long as they are able to support themselves is evinced by the significant fact that the average age of those now upon the list is 77. That they are not wasteful is proved by the fact that the whole sum expended on their relief is but £500 a year. That the institution does not restrict itself to any narrow confines is shown by the circumstance that the pensioners come from all parts of England, whilst all the expenses are paid from the annual income and interest on stock, and therefore are not disproportionate to its means. such as the institution which appeals to you through me, as a most unworthy advocate, for sympathy and support, an institution which has for its president a nobleman eight, whose whole possessions are remarkable for taste and beauty, and whose gardener's laurels are famous throughout the world. In the list of its vice presidents there are the names of many noblemen and gentlemen of great influence and station, and I have been struck in glancing through the list of its supporters, with the sums written against the names of the numerous nurserymen and seedsmen there comprised. I hope the day will come when every gardener in England will be a member of the charity. The gardener particularly needs such a provision as this institution affords. His gains are not great. He knows gold and silver more as being of the color of fruits and flowers than by its presence in his pockets. He is subjected to that kind of labor which renders him peculiarly liable to infirmity. And when old age comes upon him, the gardener is of all men perhaps best able to appreciate the merits of such an institution. To all indeed, present and absent, who are descended from the first gardener Adam and his wife, the benefits of such a society are obvious. In the culture of flowers there cannot, by their very nature, be anything solitary or exclusive. The wind that blows over the cottager's porch sweeps also over the grounds of the nobleman, and as the rain descends on the just and on the unjust, so it communicates to all gardeners, both rich and poor, an interchange of pleasure and enjoyment. And the gardener of the rich man, in developing and enhancing a fruitful flavor or a delightful scent, is, in some sort, the gardener of everybody else. The love of gardening is associated with all conditions of men, and all periods of time. The scholar and the statesman, men of peace and men of war, have agreed in all ages to delight in gardens. The most ancient people of the earth had gardens where there is now nothing but solitary heaps of earth. The poor man in crowded cities gardens still in jugs and basins and bottles. In factories and workshops people garden, and even the prisoner is found gardening in his lonely cell, after years and years of solitary confinement. Surely, then, the gardener who produces shapes and objects so lovely and so comforting should have some hold upon the world's remembrance when he himself becomes in need of comfort. I will call upon you to drink prosperity to the gardener's benevolent institution, and I beg to couple with that toast the name of its noble president, the Duke of Devonshire, whose worth is written in all his deeds, and who has communicated to his title and his riches a luster which no title and no riches could confer. Later in the evening, Mr. Dickens said, "My office has compelled me to burst into bloom so often that I could wish there were a closer parallel between myself and the American aloe. It is particularly agreeable and appropriate to know that the parents of this institution are to be found in the seed and nursery trade, and the seed having yielded such good fruit, and the nursery having produced such a healthy child, I have the greatest pleasure in proposing the health of the parents of the institution." In proposing the health of the treasurers, Mr. Dickens said, "My observation of the signboards of this country has taught me that its conventional gardeners are always jolly, and always three in number. Whether that conventionality has reference to the three graces, or to those very significant letters, 50, S, D, I do not know. Those mystic letters are, however, most important, and no society can have officers of more importance than its treasurers, nor can it possibly give them too much to do." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.